Welcome to Season 6 of the Common Ground Unity Podcast. Jesus valued unity and prayed for it. We believe unity begins with Jesus-centered relationships, gathering around a table, sharing a cup of coffee or a meal. We like to say unity begins with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another episode.
And is there any way in which we can minister to those points of difference and seek to heal them, which doesn't necessarily mean identity, but seek to come to a place where we can recognize the Christian truth that is at work in the other?
Hello and welcome to Season 6 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. I'm thrilled to be joined by guest host, friend, and mentor, Chris Miller, as we discuss receptive ecumenism with a person who articulated the concept, Dr. Paul Murray. So welcome, Chris. Chris Miller, just a little bit about him as before he jumps in here. He serves Lipscomb University as Assistant Professor of Theology and Director of Lipscomb's Institute for Christian Spirituality. He's a seasoned spiritual director and has been training other spiritual directors since 2010. He has taught systematic theology for Fuller Theological Seminary's regional campuses. Chris holds a BA in Biblical Studies, an MDiv, and an MA in History and Theology, all from Abilene Christian University, and a PhD in systematic theology from Durham University in the UK, where he encountered Paul Murray. He freely draws from the breadth of the 2,000-year-old Christian tradition, Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant, as he joyfully pursues his calling, flourishing in union with the triune God and helping others to do the same. I'm thankful to have gotten to know Chris as I've journeyed through the spiritual direction training program. He's become a friend and somebody I really enjoy hearing his insights and just spending time with him. So excited you're here, Chris.
Thank you, Drew. What a pleasure to be here with you as well as with Paul. Drew, likewise, has become a friend and thankful to have gotten to know him through the program. And Dr. Paul Murray has been a big influence in my life as he was my supervisor for my doctoral work at Durham. So let me introduce Paul briefly here. Paul is a Catholic theologian at Durham University in the UK and is the founding director of the Center for Catholic Studies. His academic work spans epistemology, ecclesiology, and ecumenism. He was educated at Durham and Cambridge, and Murray's early research engaged pragmatist philosophy and theology, culminating in the book that I came to know, Reason and Truth, Truth and Theology in Pragmatist Perspective, which led to a sustained focus for church practice, discernment, and change, which is reflected in his current project on Catholicism Transfigured. Paul is the founder and director of the International Receptive Ecumenism Initiative and has served in major theological societies, editorial roles, and official Vatican and Anglican Roman Catholic commissions. Paul, it's a pleasure to reconnect and be with you here on this podcast.
Chris and Drew, it's a real joy to be with you. Thank you for the invitation. And Chris, you know, any teacher always learns a great deal from those they work with. And I learned a great deal working with you those years ago. And I remember that one day over coffee after you'd participated in one of the Receptive Ecumenism Internationals, you said to me, you realize this is a ministry. And you were very insistent about it. Yeah, so thank you for that. Thank you for naming what was happening.
Well, Chris, since you're most familiar with Paul in this setting, go ahead and kick us off with our first question for Paul.
Absolutely. So Christian unity is obviously a major concern for you emerging from your life, your studies, and what other resources that you've experienced. Could you just tell us a little bit of the story about how your interest in promoting Christian unity began?
Well, thanks, Chris. I would kind of distinguish there between ecumenical engagement and ecumenical theology, because the second, whilst it's become a big part of my life, it had at least subjectively the feel of an accidental happening through a series of circumstances. The first, I guess, is a bit more straightforward. You know, I come from Liverpool, and when I, the time I was growing up, that was the most Catholic city in England, with a huge Irish population, a high Irish derived population. And the world I grew up in was really entirely Catholic, you know, schools, friends, extended family for whom this was all very important. So the world of Protestantism and certainly the world of Orthodoxy were not immediate to me. And it was only when I started studying theology, I shifted from engineering into theology and studied my undergraduate degree here at Durham, which was then still very much a largely Protestant theology department, primarily Anglican, but by no means exclusively so. Free church traditions, some orthodoxy, interestingly, because we had a very fine tradition of scholarship in that area, so we attracted Orthodox doctoral students particularly. So all my formal theological studies were done in a de facto ecumenical context. You know, I sat alongside, learned alongside students, fellow students from across the Christian traditions, and with academic staff who were working out of right across the Christian traditions. And one of the things I remain grateful for is that some of the staff, some of the academics, they really encouraged me as a lay Catholic student of theology to go deep into it, to go deep into other traditions, but to also continue to gain a sense of ownership, as it were, of my own tradition. There was no suggestion of there's something being wrong with that, you know? They were encouraging me to be who I am, but also to be enriched in the company of others. And that went deep. So when, after my master's work, I was employed by the Archdiocese of Liverpool in adult theological formation, it seemed just very natural to me to link up with the counterparts in the other Christian traditions in the area and to seek to find ways to work together. So I would say my finding myself in de facto ecumenical engagement was a result of my theological formation in an ecumenical context, and that became very natural to me. I did not, however, consider myself in any shape or form a formal ecumenical theologian. You know, I was working on heartland doctrinal things, creation, Christology, Trinity, pneumatology. And it was really when I moved to teach at Ushaw College back here on the outskirts of Durham, which was then functioning as the major Catholic seminary for the north of England. And it was in, unusually so for a Catholic seminary, it was in very strong institutional partnership with the Anglican training house and the Methodist training house. It was a shared degree program. Not every module was shared, but the basic program was shared in as many modules as they could find to share were. And at the heart of it was a module on church and ministry in an ecumenical setting. All the staff believed it to be a module of great importance. Ironically, none of them wanted to teach it. And being the new kid on the block, it was given to me. They didn't want to teach it because the students weren't terribly keen on it. The students loved mixing and relating with each other and doing mission-based activities together. The then rather conservative Catholic ordinands and the evangelical students at St. John's and Methodists, they loved kind of getting together and realizing that they could like each other and they could pray together. What they didn't like doing was having to sit in class and be confronted by the points of formal division between the traditions and having to think those through and articulate their own standpoint and feeling uncomfortable about it. So I was given that module, and boy, did I sweat about it over the summer before I started teaching. You know, it wasn't my area. I thought this is going to be a complicated situation. What's going to happen? And the challenge was, it's also, I have to say, that I'd kind of avoided things ecclesiological because that's where the aspects of Catholicism that I might have points of difference with or questions about would largely reside. So, you know, why give yourself a headache when you can engage in the joy of exploring the Trinity and pneumatology? So it was requiring me to move into some of the more contentious areas of theology. How to do that in a way that the relatively conservative Catholic ordinands could hear as representing the tradition appropriately, and yet the Methodists and evangelical Anglicans could see that I wasn't giving some kind of false idealized portrait and that I wasn't avoiding the difficult questions. So what I decided to do was to try and be as honest and faithful to the Catholic tradition as possible, but not to duck any of the questions. And on the questions, to ask, what is it in Anglicanism and Methodism that is different in this regard and that might in some way speak into the Catholic issue? So the kind of basic receptive ecumenical thing was sort of born through experience. And within about 3 weeks of the module, much to my surprise, I found that I was really energized. I found that I was looking forward to teaching the module. And within a few weeks, I thought, you know, something's clicked here, and this is going to take me in another direction. That I was about to finish, well, I had finished the doctorate. I was looking for the next research project. And this kind of fell into place as something that fitted with what I'd done in the doctorate on pluralism, but in a way that I would never have expected. Instead of carrying on doing kind of philosophical, theological discussions of pragmatism and theology at a more abstract conceptual level, I was actually doing something that was right, feet on the ground, hands dirty stuff in the life of the church. And I found that very energizing.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I definitely see how the seeds were planted in that time, being able to have the humility to understand your own tradition with all its flaws, and that opens you up to the willingness to learn. And that's really encouraging. I think a lot of us have had similar journeys when we engage with other Christians that we respect. And so, you know, Christians have been trying to promote unity since the beginning. I mean, you know, Paul talking to the Corinthians, he's already addressing these divisive attitudes, but we haven't done a great job of it, especially as Protestants, divide and subdivide over and over again. What are maybe some of the more common approaches of people who are trying to seek Christian unity, and what's your take on where they fall short, I guess?
Thanks, Drew. Although there were major conferences ahead of it, the 1910 Edinburgh World Mission Conference is often identified as the birth of the modern ecumenical movement. And that came out of the realization amongst 19th century Protestant missionary movements that there was a kind of performative mismatch between the gospel of reconciliation that was being proclaimed and the reality of institutional ecclesial separation. So there was a concern to come together to seek to diminish that contradiction. So right at the kind of birth of modern ecumenism is a movement that gets referred to as life and works ecumenism. And life and works ecumenism is about saying that across institutional ecclesial divides, we can still be together in prayer, we can be together in proclamation, and we can be together in works and mission. And that's been an incredibly important approach to life in institutional difference. And, you know, some would say that's all that's needed. The aspiration for any more intimate sense of communion than that is unrealistic. And we just need to kind of love each other and show that we can work across our differences. Yeah, I'm not unsympathetic to that. And I recognize that doing stuff together and praying together is the sine qua non. Without that, nothing else will happen. But I am sympathetic to the perspective that says that's for as long as we can't fully recognize ministry across the traditions. And I mean not as individuals, but institutionally, ecclesially, as long as there's not full recognition of ministry and full recognition of sacrament and full recognition of Christian identity, then we are basically living a kind of institutional lie to the world, an institutional contradiction. So I really am sympathetic with the complementary approach to ecumenism, which goes under the notion of faith and order, which seeks to say, okay, where are the points of theological, ecclesial difference? And is there any way in which we can minister to those points of difference and seek to heal them, which doesn't necessarily mean identity, but seek to come to a place where we can recognize the Christian truth that is at work in the other. And receptive ecumenism, whilst it is serving that goal differently than previous ways have done, previous ways have focused on unpicking misunderstandings, on seeking to show that we don't always need absolute identity of articulation. Receptive ecumenism assumes those approaches, but seeks to do something a bit different for a different context and a different set of challenges, a different context where those earlier strategies have been very successful, but they've probably done for the time being in the mature dialogues as much work as they can for the moment.
Thank you, Paul. So a primary constituency of this podcast comes from a group of churches, a couple hundred years old, called the Restoration Movement. And part of its identity has been restoring the New Testament church as the language that's been used historically. But this is true for other Protestants, other traditions, who not only are attempting to restore, but to be faithful somehow to the Christian tradition. So knowing your background and your studies, even in epistemology, the study of how we know things that precede or went alongside your experience in ecumenism, here's what I want to ask. How can we, as different Christian traditions, embrace the idea of our own fallibility or our own ecclesial shortcomings without feeling like we're either betraying the truth or betraying ourselves and our own Christian identity?
Yeah, this gets to the nub of it, really, doesn't it? It's the, how do we embrace a vulnerability? How do we embrace a sense of our frailty and fallibility? How can we come to see ourselves not first and foremost as the teacher with all the answers, but as a fellow pupil in the school of the Spirit? Yeah. And what I would say, in a sense, trying to put a central receptive ecumenical principle to work, I would say it's about us relinquishing any claim to adequacy in our own right. Okay, now to put that in more theological terms, it's a classic Reformation principle that the church does not equate with God in Christ and the Spirit. That's absolutely core Reformation principle, that the various reform movements found that tendency to misplace one's importance in the economy, found that tendency in the Catholic Church. So the Church is never a substitute, is never a delegated substitute for Christ and the Spirit in Calvinist understanding, in Lutheran understanding. The Church is a created witness to God in Christ and the Spirit. And as a created witness, the church is always going to be frail, fallible, sinful, and drawn to the temptation, the hubris of pride and self-sufficiency. I would say the way to encourage this amongst evangelical Protestant contexts is to say, be good evangelical Protestants. Yeah? And know thy limits and seek to be free and joyful in the before and within the evermore that is God, the evermore that is God in Christ and the Spirit. And the recognition of our frailty, of our potential limits, That is our freedom. That is our freedom. We are dependent creatures and participant Christians. We are not the truth. We're not the truth. We're drawn into the truth, but it's ever more that we'll be drawn into it.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love that joyfulness of the evermore, like that just inspires me to engage in this these conversations even more. That's beautiful. I love that humility of being able to say my understanding or my tradition's understanding of God is not the understanding of God, and definitely is not God himself. In our tradition, the Restoration Movement, we have a tendency, and this is because we've thrown aside all creeds, no creed but the New Testament. And so a lot of times conversations about theology bypass any kind of mediated understanding. So this is what the New Testament church is, because we're not looking to Luther, we're not looking to Calvin, we're looking to the New Testament. And so if you're disagreeing with me, you're not just disagreeing with me, you're disagreeing with the New Testament church, which is very difficult to have a conversation in these situations. So how do you see this playing out in our context? How can we embrace these kind of conversations in a way that honors our dependency on the New Testament without, you know, having the arrogance of saying our understanding is the final authority?
Yeah. Well, let me try and speak into that gently. Isn't it a gift that we have four gospels and not one? Isn't it a gift that we have all those particular churches that we hear about in Acts and that we hear about in the Pauline epistles? And a gift that we have the Johannine churches and the multiplicity there. And in a way, that's a kind of a created expression of the evermore. Because those churches are not identical to each other. And there isn't, if we try and flatten and synthesize the New Testament churches, plural witness, into one, fully integrated, synthesized articulation, that can serve a certain purpose of seeing what's common. But it loses so much that is distinct and sometimes in tension. So just as I guess we might want to say that each and every human has a particular breathing of God in them, and a particular sharing in the image of God that is their calling to grow into and to show to the world and to share in the communion of saints for all eternity. Perhaps, and each Christian, we do want to say with St. Paul, each Christian has a particular calling in the church and a particular gifting in the Spirit. Then each church is perhaps absolutely is sharing in the truth of God and has a particular knowledge of their sharing in the truth of God and a particular responsibility to witness to that particular sharing. But we do it well by recognizing the particularity of it. We do it well by avoiding totality and claims to totality. And we do it well, I think, by allowing the God who is evermore to move in our hearts, to give us desire to see the gifting in others, to give us the eyes to recognize and the imaginations to begin to think how it might be possible that difference is not always error and competition, but that can be complementarity.
Paul, if we look back to that classroom where you experientially were thrown into really a posture of receptive ecumenism, learning from the other traditions. And I loved the phrase you shared earlier, be who I am, enriched by the company of others.
Hello, I'm Kevin Witham, and I've been a volunteer with Common Ground Unity since its inception. And I want to take just a brief break here to discuss putting the mission of Common Ground Unity into practice and taking a new step. Unity flows out of our relationship with God. It's from the Spirit, and yet we're called to maintain the unity of the Spirit through humble, loving, gracious connection and relationships with one another. That's why Common Ground Unity was created, and that's why we want to take it to a new level that will bless you, those that participate in this ministry. And that's why we've created the Common Grounds app. It's your digital home to find local members, grab a coffee, or start a gathering right in your neighborhood. Inside, you can join or lead subgroups for local gatherings, Bible study, prayer, parenting, singles, and much more. Plus, you'll have instant access to our resource library full of videos, podcasts, and study materials. Just click the link in the show notes to join the free app. Finally, to do all of this, we urgently need your support. Of course, through your prayers, but also through your tax-deductible donation. That would really help this ministry. You can help us to share the positive message and foster unity literally around the globe. You can give today via our website or the link in our show notes. Thank you for walking this journey with us. Now back to the episode.
As you look back from that through the receptive ecumenism conferences that you have led and the books and articles that have sprung forth, how would you name some of the fruit and challenges of receptive ecumenism over the last several years?
Yeah. So fruit is fruit to the Spirit, of course. At the first Receptive Ecumenism International, when I was kind of introducing things and something of the story, I was using the language of dreaming dreams for something of what the work we were going to be doing over the next few days, dreaming dreams and the testing of dreams and the seeking to explore whether these dreams can be acted upon. And I said that some dreams that are given us are not simply bulwarks against the terror of reality, but they are breathed into us by another whose dreams they are before they become ours. And they're breathed into us to be breathed into reality. Now, I believed that then, and I feel it has been affirmed in multiple ways. First and foremost, in the ways in which heart has spoken to heart under the movement of the Spirit, and the way in which, as Drew described and as you described when you were here, Chris, of the experience of engaging the receptive ecumenism and recognizing something in it that is for our moment in the churches today, and that is seems to be of the Spirit. I would say that is the first and most important way, the way in which it's found resonance in the hearts of so many others in every continent, right across the traditions in different ways and in different age groups. Now, some of the manifestations of that, some of the kind of particular manifestations, for example, the way in which both the Vatican's dicastery for promoting Christian unity have heard something in it and recognized it and engaged it, the way in which Faith and Order Commission within the World Council of Churches have heard something in it and engaged it positively, the way in which it was formally taken, adopted by the current phase of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission, and it reshaped how bilateral ecumenism is conducted. It reshaped it. The way in which a local project across all the churches in the northeast of England bore fruit in lots of low-level ways, but one interesting way was the United Reformed Church in the UK. Firstly at local level, then they took it into national level, and then it went into international conversation, learnings around diaconal ministry from other traditions in the that participated. We had a fantastic, wonderful project led by Gabby Thomas, who teaches Anglican theology and patristics at Emory University. And Gabby led a project that was funded by the National Board of Catholic Women that was a focus group project exploring women's experiences in the UK churches, ordained and lay, and what they could learn from each other and support each other. So there's been some really down-to-earth practical things, as well as these kind of high-level international movements. There was another dimension to your question, which I'm slipping, Chris.
Challenges.
Challenges, indeed. Yeah. So trying to articulate something that is fresh for a fresh moment can sound like it is criticizing previous ways of doing things, when it's actually what it's trying to do is to say those previous ways of doing things were right and proper for the moment they were in, but we need something that's differently right and proper for this moment. So there have sometimes been a sense of, well, why do we need receptive ecumenism? Isn't all ecumenism receptive? To which it's taken a while, but I think we're there in many places as to people recognizing that it's trying to serve the faith and order agenda differently rather than abandon the faith and order agenda and the goals. Some have thought that because it's taking the long route round rather than seeking agreement on disputed matters, instead seeking where appropriate change needs to be made within each of the traditions. Some find that that's kind of just taking the low-hanging fruit and not going for the real issue. Whereas we want to say in receptive ecumenism, by dealing with the things that are in front of us now that can be dealt with through receptive learning that will change us, we will each go to a different place than we are at the moment. And as we move to that different place, things will become possible that at the moment we can't see a way to handle. In the Catholic context, whilst it might look like issues around ordination, women's ordination, or other kind of more obviously presenting difficulties and differences between traditions are what should be engaged, the absolutely crucial issue within the Catholic context is how we go about decision-making. Who's at the table? What issues get to be on the table and get to be in discussion? Now, that is a kind of, that sounds like a really, to some people, that sounds like a mundane and an insignificant matter. But if that domino was to move, all sorts of other things become possible in the Catholic context and Catholic conversation, because the actual conversations of the church would become the real and formal conversations of the church rather than being kept away from it. Another area in the early days was how to get really good traction with the new churches, kind of context you represent, charismatic churches, Pentecostal, who have understandably had some bad experiences of the formal ecumenical context, where they feel that the more traditional churches come to the table simply wanting to tell the other churches what they need to do. The Global Christian Forum was introduced to the receptive ecumenical change, the way in which it spins the telescope round by 180 degrees. And they heard in it something that they could really engage, because rather than being kept at the margins, they were being invited to come in who they are, in who they are. The 6th Receptive Ecumenism International is slated to take place in early June at the Graymore Ecumenical Institute in upstate New York. And it's being, at the moment, co-organized, the early stages of it, by the Friars of the Atonement and the Glen Mary Missionaries. the Glenmary missionaries, their kind of calling is to work as from a Catholic context with the new churches, new evangelical churches, charismatic churches, Pentecostals. And our profound hope is that that will not just be an invite being sent out for you to come to a party that others have set the table at, but that you will actually be able to share in setting the table and inviting others in, so that we can really kind of try and take this further precisely in the American context.
That was wonderful. I'm already making plans. Okay, June and New York. I think I can make that happen. We'll have to see.
But June 27.
That may be difficult. I was really captured by something you said early in that response, where you're talking about how the dreams that we have been breathed into us. And oh my goodness, that's something I'm going to go back and listen to and write down and, you know, add it to my quotes because they inspire me to be who God has created me to be and to live in to my true self, which is created in the image of Christ. And so anyway, love that. But on that subject of dreams, as we look forward and as we kind of bring this discussion towards a close, as you're looking forward to the near future about Christian unity, what is your prayer for the church, for Christians, in an era where divisiveness seems to be winning the day?
My prayer is that the evermore will affirm us in our truthful sharing and communion in Christ and the Spirit. Affirm us and confirm us in us sharing in that, in our particularity. And with that, give us confidence, Lord. Give us confidence, free confidence, not brittle defensiveness. Free confidence in what you're doing in us and what you're doing in our others. Confidence, Lord, to celebrate what we are, but to recognize our limits. Inspire us, Lord, inspire us with your movement in our others to find their capacity to minister to us, to minister your grace, so that we can be a sign to the world that difference need not be blood-soaked. That difference can be life-giving, and that difference can be held in the difference in full communion, in absolute communion, that is your life, Lord, in the Trinity. Bless us, Lord, and free us so that we can be the pale but true reflections of you call us to be. Amen.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for that prayer. I just want to say, I really appreciate that. I tend to think in abstractions and theory. And so when I ask for a prayer, I'm thinking, here's a theoretical prayer, and you lead us into the throne room of God, and you lead us into prayer. And I'm just like, yes, this is real. The Spirit is leading us into these conversations and into embodying this way of being with each other. And so I thank you for that example, just in the way you led that prayer. I appreciate that.
For my own tradition, Drew, I pray heartily for continuing Catholic conversion and continuing Catholic reform. You know, that's my responsibility as a lay Catholic. And I wouldn't dream of trying to suggest to others what they might need to do, for that needs to be discerned and worked out in one's own context. We're embarked on a big process. You might be aware of the worldwide synodal pathway that Pope Francis rolled out to try and become a more synodal church that reflects the whole of the church in its discernment processes. I mean, this is just one of the biggest things that's happened in terms of potential Catholic renewal since the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s. So I pray to God that will unfold somewhere in a way that others can begin to see more clearly any gifts that God has put in the Catholic context.
Well, thank you so much. Chris, anything else?
No. Thank you, Paul, for letting us hear in on your own life, your own prayer, and some of the primary themes of receptive ecumenism. I think it'll be a blessing to those who listen and act.
Well, thank you. Thank you all. And thank you, mediated through you, to any who care to listen. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Paul, for your time. Thank you for our listeners for joining in on this conversation. We at Common Grounds Unity have a vision to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. Imagine the good news of these gatherings modeling the prayer of Jesus in our divided world. So if you want to support this ministry, don't forget to download the CGU app where you can connect with other unity-minded Christians in your area. And please support this ministry by purchasing a copy of the Common Grounds Unity book called One Kingdom, Essays in Honor of Christian Unity. And that features more than 30 unity-minded authors, and you can find a copy on Amazon. Thanks again for joining us. We will see you next time. And until then, don't forget that unity starts with a cup of coffee.
Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and find gatherings in your area. Please don't forget to download the CGU app. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.